Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome back. We come to you 7 days a week to help you learn and improve your American English. We do this by telling you interesting stories from around the world. We always speak a little more slowly, and we use words that are easier to understand. Today, we have two stories for you. The first one is serious, because it deals with unusual weather that is causing death and sickness in many countries. Then, a bit of information about booze. That's another name for alcoholic drinks. We'll travel to New York City to hear how some people are turning back the clock. Let's get ready to listen and learn. Here is part one. People in many parts of the world are suffering from extreme heat lasting for extended periods. The World Meteorological Organization says it is too soon to know whether these heat waves are the result of climate change. The UN agency says more investigation is needed to learn the cause or causes. Anna Mateo reports.
A massive heat wave is killing people in many countries around the world. Most die of heat stroke. Heat stroke is the most serious heat-related sickness. It can develop when body temperatures reach 40.5 degrees Celsius or 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Victims need water and other cooling measures. Untreated heat stroke can lead to organ failure and death. Those who survive can suffer permanent damage. A heat wave in Pakistan will join this year's heat wave in India as one of the 10 deadliest in world history. Extreme heat has killed more than 1,500 people in Pakistan. High temperatures a few months ago in India killed nearly 2,200 people. Temperatures in areas of India and Pakistan have reached as high as 47 degrees Celsius. For Pakistan, seasonal rains are expected to begin in the middle of this month, which will cause temperatures to drop. The country should be free of the very hot weather that hit recently. But Europe does not have a similar rainy season to help break the extreme heat. Millions there may continue to suffer temperatures as high as 40 degrees Celsius. The heat wave there began June 27th. The World Meteorological Organization says it does not expect an immediate end to the extreme heat. It says extremely high temperatures and dry weather conditions will continue in many parts of Europe. Claire Nullis is an official with the World Meteorological Organization. She says many people are comparing the current heat wave in Europe to that in 2003. That heat wave killed tens of thousands of people. But she says this latest heat wave began much earlier in the summer season. It is also affecting a much wider area. However, she also says Europe is much better prepared to deal with the heat wave than it was in 2003. Omar Badur is a climate expert at the World Meteorological Organization. He says it is too early to link the current heat waves to man-made climate change. Mr. Badur says scientists need to make computer models of the heat wave after it ends. He says the model will be created from information including affected areas, temperatures, the start and end dates, and duration of the heat wave. The model will help scientists investigate the cause or causes of the extreme weather. However, Mr. Badur says the frequency and the intensity of heat waves seem to fit climate change predictions. Many parts of the western United States are also suffering from high temperatures and extremely dry conditions. The WMO warns that the states of California, Washington, and Oregon are at increasing risk of wildfires as the drought continues. The WMO says Canada is also preparing for severe wildfires. Extreme heat is also affecting southwestern and southeastern China. Recent temperatures there have risen above 35 degrees Celsius. I'm Ana Mateo.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The United States has a long history of making whiskey, a kind of alcohol. Many people across the country made the drink before the age of Prohibition. Prohibition was a 13-year period in the early 20th century when the government banned people from producing and selling alcoholic drinks. The government ended Prohibition in the early 1930s. Now, over 80 years later, the state of New York has eased its rules and even taken steps to support people who want to make whiskey. Businesses called distilleries manufacture and sell alcoholic products. Some distillers have set up operations in New York City, and they are using crops from New York area farms. Any cocktail, an alcoholic mixed drink, starts with a great spirit, like the gin and rye whiskey from the New York Distilling Company. That is the opinion of Alan Katz, who set up the company.
Finally, after 80 years post-Prohibition, we're reclaiming our taste buds in many ways.
The New York State government has made it legal for small distillers not only to operate, but also to sell their products and have tasting rooms. Mr. Katz's New York Distilling Company is one of more than 30 manufacturers in the state.
It's absolutely, resoundingly a win for us and for the New York Distilling Company because it allows us to enter the marketplace at a more reasonable cost to set up a business like this from scratch.
Nationwide, the number of small or craft distillers has grown from 250 in 2009 to over 700 today. A trade group, the Distilled Spirit Council of the United States, says small distillers earned more than $400 million from sales and services last year. Bill Potter is the head distiller for the New York Distilling Company. He says New York rye has been used in local alcohol for centuries.
The oldest distillery in North America was actually on Staten Island. It was a Dutch distillery. It was there in 1640.
Another business, Brooklyn Distilling, works with local farmers to create a regional flavor, a taste found only in the New York area. It and other companies operate under a specialty farmer's distillery license. The license requires at least 71% of local grains in the products they make. Brad Estabrook set up Brooklyn Distilling.
We've been working with the same farmer since we started, and we did the first distillation in 2010.
He says small batch spirits are successful because people care where their drink comes from and who makes it. The public's interest in local products is part of what he considers the hostile reaction to large international manufacturers. I'm Jim Tedder. You are listening to As It Is from the Learning English Department of the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Welcome to the Health and Lifestyle Report from VOA Learning English. New research suggests that kids may learn better when they are surrounded by greener spaces. Green spaces are spaces filled with vegetation, like trees, flowers, and other plants. But these days, outdoor time is competing for a child's attention with indoor activities. Children may find it difficult to resist computers, television, and electronic games. So in many parts of the world, children are spending less and less time outdoors. All this indoor activity can hurt a child's physical and mental health. But can it affect how well they do in school? Researchers in Barcelona, Spain, and in the United States are trying to answer that question. Dr. Payam Dadvand works at the Center for Research and Environmental Epidemiology in Barcelona. He and his team study how the environment affects health. Dr. Dadvand and his team studied more than 2,600 children from 36 schools in the city. The kids were 7 to 10 years old. The researchers used information from satellites to learn how much green space surrounded each school. Over 1 year, the children took computerized tests 4 times. The tests measured memory and attention span. The researchers then created mathematical models to compare the amount of green spaces around the schools with the test scores. The researchers found that the children with higher contact with green space had better ability to memorize. They were also more attentive. The team believes that good air quality is the main reason for the results. More trees means less air pollution. Scientist Jordi Sunyer also worked on the study. Mr. Sunyer says that schools surrounded by greenery had less air pollution in the classrooms. However, some experts question the use of satellite images to determine the amount of green space. Satellite images would not show if the green spaces are actually usable, such as playgrounds and parks. Also, satellite images would not show if children actually come into contact with the green spaces. Other experts say this study does not consider other factors that may play a part in a child's learning environment. But the findings of the Barcelona study seem to support a 6-year study on elementary schools in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. Researchers there studied students at 905 schools from 2006 to 2012. They found that students in schools that had more green spaces scored higher on standardized testing in English and math. The researchers in the Massachusetts study used more factors than the Barcelona study, factors such as race, English as a second language, parent income, and school attendance. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we look at the presidential election of 2000.
It was an election that few Americans would soon forget.
The presidential race looks jar-lid tight. We could be in for a long night as voters decide whether Vice President Al Gore or Texas Governor George Bush will be the next president of the United States. It is that close.
In 2000, Americans were preparing to elect a new president in November. The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Bill Clinton would be leaving office, so his Democratic Party needed to choose a new candidate. The Democrats nominated Clinton's vice president, Al Gore. Gore chose Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut as his running mate. Lieberman became the first Jewish candidate ever nominated by a major party to such a high office. He was first elected to the Senate in 1988. Al Gore was born in Washington in 1948. He was named after his father, a United States Senator from Tennessee. The future vice president grew up in Washington and in Carthage, Tennessee, where his family had a farm. He studied government at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and graduated in 1969. That was during the Vietnam War. His father opposed American involvement in that war. But the young Al Gore joined the Army and spent about 6 months of his service as a military journalist in Vietnam. Back in civilian life, Gore again worked as a reporter. Later, he studied religion and then law at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. But he dropped out of law school to enter politics. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1976. He became known for supporting nuclear arms control and protecting the environment. Al Gore was elected to the Senate in 1984. He was re-elected 6 years later. That was after he had tried to become the Democratic candidate for president in 1988. Then, in 1992, Bill Clinton won the party's nomination and asked Al Gore to be his vice president. As vice president, Gore became known for his work on issues involving the environment, technology, and foreign relations. In March 1999, he gave an interview on CNN. During that interview, he talked about his plans to enter the race for the presidential nomination the following year. He made the statement that during his service in Congress,
I took the initiative in creating the internet.
He went on to say that he took the initiative in moving forward other efforts important to the economy, environmental protection, and educational improvements. But his comment about the internet led to jokes and criticism that he was claiming to have actually invented it. The Republicans nominated Texas Governor George W. Bush as their presidential candidate. For his running mate, he chose Dick Cheney, a former Secretary of Defense. George Walker Bush was born in Texas in 1946, the oldest child of former President George Herbert Walker Bush. He grew up in the Texas cities of Midland and Houston. He graduated from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, and earned a master's in business administration at Harvard University. During the Vietnam War years, he was a pilot in the Texas Air National Guard. Later, he worked in the state's oil and gas industry. In 1988, Bush worked on his father's winning campaign for president. Later, he became one of the owners of the Texas Rangers, a Major League Baseball team. In 1994, George W. Bush was elected governor of Texas. He was re-elected 4 years later. Several other candidates also ran for president in the November 2000 election. These minor, or so-called third-party candidates, included activist Ralph Nader. He represented the Green Party. He criticized large corporations for having too much influence in America. Pat Buchanan, a conservative, ran as the Reform Party candidate. Public opinion surveys showed that the race between George Bush and Al Gore would be extremely close. The election took place on November 7th. More than 100 million people voted for them. Al Gore received about 540,000 more of those votes than George Bush did. But winning the popular vote does not make someone president. Americans do not directly elect their president. When they vote for a candidate, what they are really doing is voting for electors. The number of electors for each state is based on the size of its congressional delegation, which is based on population. These electors then vote in December in a system known as the Electoral College. The Electoral College officially elects the president. In the 2000 election, there were 538 electors in the Electoral College. To become president, the winner needed a simple majority of 270. Al Gore won the popular vote, but neither he nor George Bush won a majority of the electoral votes. Not that any of this was clear on election night.
Bulletin, Florida pulled back into the undecided column. This thing is so wild, wacky, and woolly, nobody knows how it's going
to
come out.
CNN right now is moving Florida to the too close to call column.
Too close to call.
Florida is now too close to call. I want to say that again. It's a confusing situation. Now, if you're disgusted with us, frankly, I don't blame you.
Florida is a big southern state. It had enough electoral votes to make either candidate the winner. Election officials counted almost 6 million votes on election night. George Bush had slightly more votes than Al Gore, but not enough to avoid a recount. Florida state law calls for a recount when the difference between two candidates is less than one-half of 1% of the votes. State recounts normally involve the governor, but the governor of Florida said he would not get involved. That was because the governor was Jeb Bush, George Bush's brother. And there were other issues with the election. Some black voters said election workers had unjustly prevented them from voting. There were also problems with voting machines and ballots. In one area, some Gore supporters believed they had voted for Pat Buchanan by mistake. The names were next to one another on the ballot. Democrats said the ballot design was illegal. Republicans said Democratic Party officials had never objected to it. The disputed election results in Florida introduced a new term into popular speech. Americans began talking about chads. Whether it was hanging chads, pregnant chads, or dimpled chads, it amounted to the same problem. It meant that a voting machine had not cleanly punched out a bit of paper called a chant when the voter made a choice. As a result, the ballot would confuse a vote-counting machine and make the choice unreadable. That, in turn, meant election workers had to look at each questionable ballot and try to decide the voter's choice. All this took place with the nation and the world watching and wondering who would become America's next president. Something else only added to anger and debate over the situation in Florida. Florida's Secretary of State, its chief election officer, Catherine Harris, also happened to be a leader of the Bush campaign there.
Governor George W. Bush, 2,912,790.
Almost 3 weeks after the election, Florida officials declared George Bush the winner of the state's 25 electoral votes. That gave him a total of 271. Out of 6 million ballots, state officials said he had defeated Al Gore by 537 votes. But the election was still not over. Gore and his supporters in Florida asked the courts to reject the results because of what they said were the many voting problems. The Florida Supreme Court ordered another count of the disputed ballots. Bush campaign officials quickly appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The court said Florida law did not explain how officials should judge the ballots. The court found the situation in Florida unconstitutional because there were different standards around the state. The justices also said not enough time remained to settle the issue before the Electoral College had to meet. On December 12th, the court voted 7-2 to end the recount and 5-4 against ordering a new one. 6 days later, on December 18th, members of the Electoral College met in each state capital and the District of Columbia. They made the election official. George W. Bush would become the 43rd President of the United States.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
He took office on January 20th, 2001. The election dispute had divided Americans. But less than a year later, the nation was brought together by events that would set the direction for the presidency of George W. Bush.
A plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened just a few moments ago.
The United States suffered the worst terrorist attacks in its history on September 11th, 2001, a day that would be remembered as 9/11. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.